Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast breaking news edition. No news is good news, Eric. Did you know that? Wait, no, this is bad.
You scared me. I was like, did I miss something? Just peeking behind the curtain here. So I have two monitors set up at my desk. One monitor and my laptop. So I usually use that other monitor for TweetDeck. But when recording, I put the podcast notes in that monitor. So it's like larger for me to read because I have old man eyes. And so I don't have TweetDeck open. So when you said breaking news, I was like, I must have missed something.
Nope. We don't have a lot to talk about, but you know what? We committed to doing, even in no news era, every 2 weeks. So we have like an update on the not update, I guess. But we're going to play a little game involving the designated hitter. And then we have the regular segments, because if we didn't, we wouldn't have a show. Five questions from Craig and Dodgers Rewind, all of that after this.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
All right, Eric, are we still in a labor crisis in baseball today?
I forgot the setup last time, Simpsons reference. You know, if speaking of that, it's funny. So we're obviously still in the lockout. No transactions for major league players. Today, we were recording on 2-2-22, which is Groundhog Day, but also the Giants, I believe, announced today they are retiring Will Clark's number 22 this year at some point. Or I guess they were going to do it in 2020, but because of the pandemic, it didn't happen. But the ceremony is going to be this year. But so they announced on 2-2-22, and he was number 22. Clayton Kershaw, you may have heard of him. He'll come up later in the show. He famously wears number 22 because he grew up liking the Rangers version of Will Clark. So maybe I was thinking, maybe when you said breaking news, I was thinking maybe they ended the lockout, or Clayton Kershaw posted on Instagram, hey, just so you know, when we start up again, I'm re-signing with the Dodgers, number 22, blah, blah, blah. Or it could have been, you know what? Will Clark was a Ranger. It's 2-2-22. I'm going to be a Ranger wearing number 22, blah, blah, blah. But nope, it wasn't that. It was because there's no news. So, yep. That's where we're at.
So what is the update on not a lot of tangible things that go on? Baseball, Major League Baseball and the Players Union keep meeting for what – I don't think I've ever seen an accurate description of how long they go, but the impression is not very long. They don't meet for very long. They exchange proposals, and then they go home and say how upset everybody was.
Yeah, I think the Dallas stuff that was all like in person were like last minute before the lockout, where I tend not to read a lot into that. I know there was one meeting that was like 7 minutes in that December thing, where, which is, you know, kind of ridiculous, but I was like, Eugene Friedman, labor lawyer, on Twitter has been pretty good at explaining this. A lot of it is like, there's a lot of like different sides, like, okay, we meet for a little bit, then both sides like break out and caucus for a second, and then they come back. I think like the meeting, they've met like three times, I think, since we last recorded 2 weeks ago, on like major stuff. And like, I think yesterday's, this is, we're recording Tuesday, this was, or Wednesday, this was Tuesday when they met. I think they met for like 90 minutes. That seems like pretty normal. Like, I don't think there's like, let's start the meeting and they're like, hey, fuck you. No, fuck you. And then we're out of here. It's not that, you know what I mean? But it kind of is, like, on some level, because some of the offers are like kind of ridiculous. But like, I believe at various times, I didn't collect all the adjectives, I just wrote a couple down, but heated was how some of the talks were described. Spirited was another one that was kind of funny. So like, we talked about this, our standing bet is, I said opening day would be April 1st, forgetting that opening day is actually March 31st. You said June 1st, May 1 is the midpoint there. I still think it's going to be, season's going to start at some point in April. It could be a situation where they ended up missing like a week or two or whatever, and you have to adjust accordingly. But I'm not as like, long-term like worried as I might be in this scenario. It's just going to be an annoying process to get there, I think. So my big thing is like, both sides, players and owners, seem like they're structurally on the same page. Very roughly, they're very far apart in some of the numbers, like, but that's just a matter, that'll come with like going back and forth, right? Like figuring it out. Like I don't think, like, the players dropped their proposal to start free agency sooner than 6 years. That's like a major thing. They both sort of agree on some sort of bonus pool for high performing players before arbitration. So like guys with 0 to 3 years service time. And like, you'll see, this is sort of an example of this. The AP sort of had this detail. All the sites that have been recapping it have had this. But so last week, I believe, the players, they want for that bonus pool a total of $105 million, which, if you think about it, 30 teams, it's about $3 million a team to, like, spread among quote-unquote high-performing. It's a matter of figuring out how they determine that is one thing. But then the owners are like, no, the total bonus pool across the sport is going to be $10 million. So, like, that's just a joke of an offer, sort of. But, like, that's sort of where they're at. Like, they're far apart money-wise, but, like, the structure is there. The minimum salary last year was $570,500. The players, I don't think they've this has been back and forth. The players, I believe, their ask at, right now starts at $775,000. The owner's original like offer, like, we'll go to $600,000, which I believe if you account for inflation is actually lower than, like, you know, many recent years. So like, but then they up their offer to $615,000. But also they have a weird thing where they don't allow teams to pay players more than that. Like right now, like, you know, like Edwin Rios, I don't have the guys in front of me, but some of the guys like on the Dodgers, they didn't earn exactly $570,500. Like Will Smith was like something like $590,000, you know, something like that. But I think under this system the owners want, they don't even want that ability, which is very weird. So I think, but in terms of the system, it's still the same system. They just have to figure out like how to distribute. So I don't think it's as dire, and I just think once you get closer to where it's a threat of missing things, and then like ultimately they kind of want the same thing, so I think they're going to work it out. The another big thing they're far apart on is the competitive balance tax. I don't think they've actually discussed this or changed it since December, but the numbers that are out there is the players wanted it to start at, it was $210 million last year, the threshold. They want it to start at $245 million and then escalate to $273 million by the end of the five-year CBA. The owners are like, let's go from $210 to $214, and then over the course of the CBA, it goes all the way up to $220. And so, like, they're far apart on this stuff. That's Hannah Kaiser at Yahoo has more on that. I will link to that in the show notes. So just as a sort of point of reference, the last CBA, the – threshold was 195 million in 2017. It went up to 210. So like the owner's now offering a, even starting at 214, which is low given where the revenues are in the sport. And then only going up 6 million in 5 years is kind of wild. So like, it's not consistent with like even previous CBAs. So like, it's just stuff they'll sort of figure out. It's all incremental movement right now, which is, that's sort of the annoying part. So it seemed like yesterday, this was like the third recent in-person meeting. It seemed like every report was like, well, now it's pretty obvious that spring training isn't going to start on time, at least like the reporting dates. Well, that's been like obvious for a while. It's just like, I think it's not official, but it's like, it became like, okay, it's pretty clear now. Like, I guess that's the sort of thing. Now I will say this, like, again, I think structurally they're roughly on the same page. So it's just a matter of like figuring out what they want. The owners want like expanded playoffs. So I think they're going to eventually give something up to get that. And I think that's where the movement happens. And it seemed like both sides in this whole thing want a universal DH. So I think that's going to happen like we had in 2020 in the pandemic season. So what we are going to do today is we're going to draft Dodgers. Wait, draft Dodgers? Is this a – I don't know. Anyway, we're going to draft Dodgers to figure out which of us has the group of players with the most plate appearances as a designated hitter in 2022.
Now what happens when there's not a season?
Wait a minute. We tie.
Yeah.
we're both champions in that scenario. So I think we discussed we're going to do a team of five players each. I will give you the option. Let's do a snake style. So do you want to go first or second? So you'd have second and third in that scenario.
I'll go first.
Okay. Let me open up my new little thing. Oh, so I provided a sort of – the Dodgers in 2020 sort of famously split up DH. They didn't have, like, you know, Nelson Cruz type. They kind of gave people off days, used it in that regard. I think Joc Pederson had the most starts, 12 out of the 60 games. A.J. Pollock, Justin Turner had 10 each. So like they spread it around quite a bit. So I think that's what we're gonna do, and that's where we're at. So yeah, we are at five players each. You go first. I will have the next two after that.
Justin Turner.
All right. I was gonna write Turner, and then I'd be like, wait, do you mean Trey or Justin? okay. So I will go. I will go AJ Pollock.
Yep.
And then. Also, our good friend at, you know what? I'm going Will Smith.
That was my next one.
You have two now.
But you stole mine. This is not very nice, Eric.
Fair. It's not fair.
It's so funny because I want to name like mystery player, not currently on the 49er, you know.
Yeah, you totally could. All we're going to judge this on is total plate appearances, not like performance or war.
Right.
That. It's like, I think it'd be really hard to break that out.
Yeah. Let's do Matt Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have another one.
Position famously the batter's box. So.
Right.
He actually started five times in 2020 at DH, fifth most on the team.
At the gambling risk, when is Edwin Rios supposed to be back? Is he supposed to be?
I believe he's supposed to be ready to go whenever they start like spring training.
I'll say Rios then. I'll say a bounce back. That last year's not very good performance. All due to injury, and he'll be good to go.
Yep, and it gives him a shot to play either. Yeah, exactly. That's a worthy, nice pick. So I will go just as a precaution because we're still not sure exactly what the aftermath is from elbow stuff. So I'm going to go Max Muncy.
Okay.
And I will also let's say – I'm just because he tends to play in the field a lot, but just because he plays all the time, I'm going to just say Chris Taylor.
Yeah, I think he'll just almost always be in the field, but I get it.
Right.
I see where you're going. I'll say Zach McKinstry.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have
another,
one more?
Another bat-heavy person. Yep. So who's your last pick?
I'm figuring that out. I'm looking at the Dodgers 40-man right now. They're going to have to add a player too, Eric.
You know what? I agree with you. We should discuss this on future podcasts. We'll need the content. We know it.
So. And you know, it's really funny. All these players look all the same, kind of dark and shadowy. Like,
found it. Exactly. Yeah.
MLB.com is where I'm at.
The lighting was weird that day when John Suhu took those pictures.
I guess I'll say another player who I'll trust to figure things out 1 year forward, Luke Rayleigh.
Nice. I like your strategy here. I am in the wrong spot. Okay. Okay. So you took Luke Rayleigh. So I have one more pick. I will just go here. I'm just going to say Mookie Betts, just in case.
Sure.
Some of the hip stuff comes back, and they just want to give him the governor, as it were, to sort of get him off his feet, but also hit. So yeah, I went with a lot more top heavy, but like, you know,
these are actually good players.
Yeah, but like
for
not
sure,
necessarily UBDH. Like
yeah, no, different strategies for sure.
Yeah. So just to recap, my team is AJ Pollock, Will Smith, Max Muncy, Chris Taylor, Mookie Betts. You have Justin Turner, Matt Beatty, Edwin Rios, Zach McKinstry, and Luke Rayleigh. So clearly Trey Turner and Cody Bellinger will lead the Dodgers in this. Okay, so looking back, Dodgers have had interleague play. The baseball has had interleague play since 1997. Who has the most regular season home runs as a designated hitter for the Dodgers during that time?
Trivia. I will answer that after this.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right. Who has the most regular season home runs as a designated hitter for the Dodgers?
The one hint I was going to mention is, since 97, the Dodgers have played 220 games in American League parks in the regular season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give you an idea of the scale.
And just to confirm, we're also counting all of last year, right? Or 2 years ago, excuse me.
Yep. And then, and just to give you a heads up on your draft, Justin Turner has the most plate appearances of any Dodger DH.
He was up there. My first guess was going to be Sean Green.
He actually has zero home runs, only six games and 25 plate appearances.
Interesting. I would have figured more near the end. And there,
I thought he would have played more as well.
The three guesses I had in order before I asked for a hint were: next was Andre Ethier.
He also had zero home runs, nine games, 38 plate appearances.
What schlubs. All right, and then my last guess before you gave me the hint was Justin Turner.
Yeah, so he has those 124 plate appearances, one home run. but he's tied for second.
I have one more guess that I just thought of before we got there. Almeida Saenz.
So he has the second most plate appearances with 75.
Yep.
Also one home run. this isn't much of a hint, but
thanks, buddy.
Since interleague play began, The Dodgers have 20 home runs total as a DH. It's the lowest in the majors. The Expo Nats have 23. Actually, I'm just looking here, and just in case it actually, I was saying if it, seeing if it accidentally credited like that was only Expos or something. But then the Pirates have 27. Everyone else has at least 33 home runs. So the Dodgers have the fourth worst OPS, 690 among major league teams as a DH in that time. So it's been rough. The All other right. hint yeah, I, will, go ahead. I will give you is there have been five different players to hit a home run as a DH in the playoffs. One of them is one of these players who's tied for the regular season home run. So he technically has the most DH home runs. Mm. If you count regular season and postseason, and this person hit the postseason home run at Fenway Park.
Brain. All right. I have two guesses I'm going to throw out there. I'm going to ignore the Fenway hint because it's just screwing with my brain. Jock Peterson.
So Jock has won. Regular season home run. He also has one postseason home run,
okay.
which actually puts him in the, I guess he's all alone in second place.
All right. My last guess, and then you're just going to tell me is Yasmani.
Oh, I don't even know if he. He has never played DH for the
Interesting.
Dodgers.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was. A little surprising.
Yeah. Anyways, I'm tapped out.
Okay. So the person in question who hit the home run in the 2018 World Series, Matt Kemp, three home runs in the regular season as DH, one in the World Series, game one. The other person at the top is Corey Seager, three home runs as DH. Both Seager in 10 games. 44 plate appearances, Matt Kemp in 9 and 40. The other postseason DH home runs, Edwin Rios, another Jacob pick for this year. Yeah. Kike Hernandez, I forgot. His game 7 tying home run was actually pinch hitting for DH Jock Peterson in game 7. And then Jock Peterson in the 2017 World Series, Mike Davis, game 5 of the 88 World Series. So, yeah. And then it's all like outside of those three people with multiple home runs, everyone else is just tied with one. Chad Kruder is one of the people. Oh, no. Edwin Rios is also a regular season plus postseason. So he's a two home run guy. Chad Kruder, Mike Kincaid, Ramon Hernandez, Luis Gonzalez are some of these guys with one. It's a great list. So, yeah.
Well, you have a Dodgers rewind for us?
I do. We're going to go with Joe Black this time. I was looking. I thought we might have done him before, but we have not on Dodgers Rewind. So he's a pretty interesting character in Dodgers history. So he pitched parts of 6 seasons for the Baltimore Elite Giants in the Negro Leagues. Now, the first 3 of those years, he sort of barely pitched for them. He was just sort of around. He was also in the Army and in college, so that was part of it. And then from 1946 to 1948, he was like 120 innings a year for the Baltimore Elite Giants those years. Then he completed his college degree at Morgan State in Baltimore in 1949-1950. Then the Dodgers purchased both Joe Black's contract and Jim Gilliam's contract from Baltimore in 1951. And then he was in the minors that year. Both of them were. Gilliam didn't debut until 1953. Joe Black debuted on May 1st, 1952. He was 28. He was the 5th Black pitcher in Major League history and the 5th Black Dodgers player. So in order for the Dodgers, obviously Jackie Robinson first, 1947. Later that year, pitcher Dan Bankhead, he was the 1st Black MLB pitcher. He also homered in his first at-bat, which was sort of a fun quirk Then Roy Campanella, 1948, Don Newcomb, 1949, and then Joe Black, 1952. So he had in 1952, he was used almost exclusively in relief. But it was like, he still pitched a lot. Like he had seven relief appearances lasting at least five innings, I believe. One of them was an extra inning game where he pitched eight innings. He had 15 relief appearances of at least three innings. His first 54 games in the majors were all in relief. And then towards the end of the year, the Dodgers starting pitching was pretty thin. So he started twice at the end of the year to sort of get ready for the World Series because they were going to win the pennant. In his first start, he pitched a complete game, gave up two unearned runs and one against the Boston Braves. He was also Jackie Robinson's roommate in 1952 and sort of credited him with sort of acclimating him to the majors and like giving him pretty sage advice. He was awesome that year. 15-4, 2.15 ERA. He pitched 56 games, 142 innings. He would have led the National League in ERA, but he fell 12 innings shy of qualifying. Now, it was funny, the pitcher who did lead the league in ERA that year was another rookie and a reliever, Hoyt Wilhelm, who went on – a knuckleballer who went on to the Hall of Fame. He had a 2.43 ERA and 159 innings pitch, so he barely made the requirement, but he did. Black's 128 and a third innings in relief that year are the fourth most in Dodgers history in one season. Mike Marshall famously with the record setting 1974 year is number one with 208, which is funny. Charlie Huff, 1976, 142 and two thirds. Ron Peronoski had 129 innings in 1962. So that year, Black won the Rookie of the Year over Hoyt Wilhelm, getting 19 out of 24 first-place votes. It wasn't that close of a vote. Also, Black finished third in MVP. There was basically like a split between Joe Black, starter Robin Roberts, and Hoyt Wilhelm in for like the pitcher spot, and then Hank Sauer, the Cubs outfielder who led the National League in homers and RBIs on a very bad Cubs team, ended up winning. Black got eight first-place votes. So did Hank Sauer. Robin Roberts, who probably should have won. He won 28 games. No one knew what WAR was at the time, but he had 8.6 WAR. He got seven first-place votes. He was in second. Black was third. Wilhelm fourth. So it was a very, very close vote. In Joe Black's Sabre bio, written by Peter Dreyer, he suggests that the controversy over this like vote, plus that the fact that pitchers were now like being considered over position players. I was looking at this, some of the high, like I think Black at the time through 1952, this would have been like the, in the top 10 of like reliever innings in a season. So this was sort of a relatively new thing of relievers being used this way. So I think a lot of people were like, well, relievers are like everyday players. So like maybe we'll give them more credit than like a starter. Jim Constantine won the 1950 MVP for the Phillies in this role. So I think this sort of helped pave the way to create a separate award for pitchers, which led to the Cy Young Award in 1956. So that was part of it. So Black, he's used as a reliever all year. And then they're like, yeah, we might need him to start in the World Series. So, oh, yeah, by the way, he's a rookie. He's a 28-year-old rookie, but still a rookie. He starts game one. Against the Yankees, he wins 4-2 with a complete game, the first Black pitcher to win a World Series game. He also started game four. He gave up one run in seven innings but lost. And then game seven, he gave up three runs in five and a third innings, lost that as well. The Dodgers lost. The Dodgers scored a total of two runs in those last two starts, so it was very tough luck. I was looking back of all the times the Dodgers lost to the Giants, and it was a lot of times. 52 had to be the toughest. Like they were up 3-2 on the Yankees, going back to Ebbets Field for two games, and they lost both. Their offense went quiet, which is that never happens in the playoffs. I don't know what people are worried about, but yeah. So that World Series, Black 21 and a third innings pitched again as a rookie, 2.53 ERA. He was very, very good. Chuck Gresham, the Dodgers manager, this is for the Sabre bio again. His quote was, let's put it this way, where would we be without him? About talking about Joe Black. Another quirk here. So Black started games 1, 4, and 7. His last two starts were on 2 days rest because they played the 7-game World Series in 7 days. I thought when I looked at this, I was like, okay, it was a Subway Series, so that's probably why they did that. But I looked this up. Every single World Series from 1944 to 1957 was scheduled with no off days. So even like ones that were like St. Louis, New York, or whatever, or something like that, or, you know, like Philly, New York, it was wild. I had no idea. Like 55 when the Dodgers won, it was all over 7 days. Like, that's wild to me. So like, you know, starting 1-4-7 used to be sort of the thing, but like it takes on added like amazingness when it's all in a 7-day period. So Black wasn't really the same after the rookie season. He ended up I forgot which year it was, but I think he like tore stuff in his shoulder, and I'm not sure exactly how they sort of figured it out, that like they didn't perhaps have the maybe they didn't know exactly what was bothering him, but he just wasn't as good. He did pitch for parts of 6 years in the National League and American League with the Dodgers, Reds, and Senators. He had a 3.91 ERA, a 1.02 ERA plus in the NL and AL. He was 113 ERA plus with Brooklyn. He was 114 ERA plus in the Negro Leagues. Very good. He was traded to the Reds in June 1955 for an outfielder, Bob Borkowski, sort of a journeyman, barely played. Now, we sort of take for granted, I think, sometimes, like, sort of everyone who plays for a team who wins gets a ring. I think, like, Ross Stripling, for instance, got a ring for the Dodgers, even though he was traded midseason. That seems, like, pretty commonplace. But, like, I think it took a while for Black to get one. I maybe it wasn't common at the time. Peter O'Malley, there was a note in the New York Times about how eventually he did later give Joe Black a World Series ring for 55, even though he wasn't around for the end of the year. Post-career, he did a lot. Like, he was a scout for a while. He taught junior high. He worked for Greyhound. He ended up in Phoenix, seems to be sort of beloved there. He was on the board of directors for the baseball assistance team, like helping baseball inner cities. He helped lobby Commissioner Faye Vincent for a group of Negro League veterans and their spouses to receive lifetime health insurance in the 90s, back when they were like figured out that they weren't covered by like the pension plan that like old major leaguers were. So he was very instrumental in that. The Arizona Fall League created an MVP award in 2002, and they named it after Joe Black. Joe Black passed away that year. So yeah, he's had a quite a mark throughout baseball. So very interesting Dodger, and I was surprised we hadn't talked about him. So that's why I wanted to sort of tell his story. Now, Joe Black, he won Rookie of the Year. The Rookie True. Of the Year was relatively new. You got it. You nailed it. That was relatively new.
I was listening.
But he was the third Dodger to win Rookie of the Year in the 6 years at that point of the award. Who were the first two?
Jackie.
Jackie who? No, I'm just kidding.
Onassis. No. Man. Was it Campy?
It was not.
My next guess is Don Newcomb.
That's right.
Hey, there we go. Yeah, 1949. I knew that was like in the punch bowl, so to speak. Yep. And I just couldn't remember. All right. Look at that.
Look at us.
You and me, man. Hey, speaking of friends and friendliness, we have a friend. His name is Craig. He sends us stuff. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready.
It's time for
Questions from Craig.
5 questions, starting with trivia from our friend Craig. The Cincinnati Bengals will be in Inglewood for the Super Bowl against the Los Angeles Rams. There's no rivalry between these two teams, but there was a great Queen City versus City of Angels rivalry, the Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds. Today's trivia is about that rivalry. You ready?
Oh, no.
Yep. from 1969 to 1993, 5 Dodgers hit 17 or more home runs against the Reds. Can Eric name these players?
So 69 and 93. So let's just go right off the top. Ron Say and Steve Garvey.
Reverse those two, but then you have them in order. Uh-huh. Garvey, Garvey 1, Say 2. Garvey with 36, Say with 27.
Damn.
Okay. 17 home runs. 27. Let's go also with Pedro Guerrero.
Not on the list. He hit 15.
Jerk.
I thought you liked him.
Let's say, you know what? Even though it's, what about Davey Lopes? I know he was second base, didn't hit a lot of power.
16.
Come on. Let's, wow. 69 to 93. So there's something. What about Mike Marshall?
Number 3 with 21. I'll let you know the two remaining names each had 17 on the dot.
Of course. Let's go with Dusty Baker?
Dusty Baker is one of them.
I get Joe Ferguson.
Nope. One more guess, and I'm going to tell you.
All right. Reggie Smith.
Rick Monday.
Almost went with Monday.
Nice. Of course, the Reds and Dodgers have played each other since the National League was formed. There are five Dodgers. The answer is being cut off. One second. There are five Dodgers who have hit 30 or more home runs in their career against the Reds. Name these sluggers. Of note,
Steve Garvey,
who is one of those players. Look at that. Exactly. The hint was you've already named one of the players.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so let's just go with the Gil Hodges, Duke Snider.
He did it again. Number one and number two, opposite order. Duke Snider number one, Gil Hodges
Eric,
two.
Eric Karras. Nope. Really?
Nope.
You're a liar. So this is weird because...
And Steve Garvey's third on this list with the 36.
I don't... Oh, man. It doesn't make sense, but I'm just going to say Mike Piazza.
Nope.
All right. Willie Davis?
Nope.
No, he didn't hit that many. Oh, Gil Hodges?
You already said Gil Hodges.
Did I?
You did.
Oh, yeah, I said Gil Hodges and Duke Snider. Well, who was I thinking
of then? Just say Gil Hodges three times. Hey,
Roy Campanella.
Number 5 of 32.
So I'm missing one?
You are missing one. You know what? I'm going to give you the years. 46 to 60 is how long this is when this player played.
46 to 60? What? okay, wait. Carl Farrillo?
There you go. Well done. Nice. I thought maybe the years would help.
It definitely helped, but I was like, you know, it threw me off for a second. Like, yeah.
Now do the same for the Reds. Name those five players from Cincinnati who hit 30 or more home runs against the Dodgers. Hint. Three are Hall of Fame and one played for the Dodgers.
Frank Robinson.
Number one, 42 home runs.
Oof. Barry Larkin?
Nope.
Well, he is Hall of Fame. So. Oh, well, okay. Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan.
Pulling back up, I know Johnny Bench is. Joe Morgan is not.
Tony Perez?
Tony Perez is. 33 home runs right, for Tony so
there's,
Perez.
There's the Hall of Famers.
31 for Johnny Bench.
Eric Davis? Did I say him already?
No. You did not.
Is he one? Eric Davis is not one?
Is not one. Sorry. Should have made that
That's
more
okay.
clear.
Ted Klazuski? I don't know if he was there.
Number 37.
He is. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, number three. 37 home runs, sure, number two on this list.
This list
went far, man.
George Foster.
Number five. Well done, dude.
Nice.
Okay. I did not think you were going to get all five.
Purely
on your reaction.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, there's more. You ready? In the wild card era, that was a two-part one question. Normally there's only four. Craig went deep. In the wild card era, five Reds pitchers have collected 36 or more strikeouts against the Dodgers. Who are those whiff masters? I love Craig's thesaurus usage.
Turn of phrase.
I want the Craig baseball thesaurus. Only one did this in the 1990s, and two of them did this against Dave Roberts' managed teams.
Okay, so I'm going to go Aaron Harang.
Aaron Harang, number three on this list with 39.
Johnny Cueto.
Number four on this list, 36, tied with the fifth place as well.
Bronson Arroyo.
Number two on this list with 51.
All right. Jose Rijo?
No.
Oh, alrighty. I'm trying to, I don't know why the 90s part is. Let's go with Pete Harnish.
No, not even on my list.
Am I missing one of the people who are against current Dodgers, like, or Dave Roberts-ish?
Correct.
Is that right? Okay. Oh boy.
I'll give you a hint. Number one on this list is an old friend. Using the Eric's definition of old friend. I want to make clear.
Sure. Oh, okay. Oh, Homer Bailey.
There you go.
I was
about to say that's not a hint until I make sure we know
I was going to say Sonny Gray until I figured it was something like that. Okay, so I'm missing still one more regular, like the 90s one, right?
Correct. You are missing the 90s player. 95 to 97.
All right, I don't think this is right, but Dave Burba.
Nope, I'm just going to give it to you. John Smiley. Yep.
Damn it, all right.
And for the last question, in the wild card era, five Dodger pitchers have recorded 50 or more strikeouts against the Reds. Please name these pitchers, and note, three of them recorded at least some of these strikeouts in the 90s.
Hideo Nomo.
Number two on the list with 69 strikeouts.
Nice. Ramon Martinez.
Wow, not in the top 16.
You're obviously lying.
Oh, yeah, he's in the top 16, but not on the list. Sorry.
Ishmael Valdez.
Ramon Martinez had 43 for what it says. Ishmael Valdez, number three in the list with 57.
Kevin Brown.
Kevin Brown is not in the top, doesn't have 50. He had 43.
Of course. Eight on this list. Oh, Chan Ho Park.
Chan Ho Park is fourth on this list with 56.
All right, so I think...
You've named the 90s players.
I was just going to say, yeah, that covers that. Let's go with our friends Clayton Kershaw.
Number one on the list, would you believe, with 100.
What? So here, now the question is... I'm going to go Chad Billingsley here.
Number five on the list with 52.
Nice.
Right. There you did great.
I'm happy with that.
ESPN.com is now publishing their all-time in their all-time ranking. Blah, I'm going to say that again. ESPN.com is now in the all-time ranking game. On February 1st, they began to publish their top 100 Major League Baseball players of all time. Lists are fun things, and this question is about the ranking of Clayton Kershaw at number 52. Kershaw is ranked higher than his colleagues, Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer, which seems okay to me. He was also higher than Steve Carlton, Lefty Grove. I find that a bit premature since Kershaw is an active player, and those two greats amassed totals and or achievements that Kershaw has not approached. What do you think, and when does this podcast start doing all-time lists?
in like a month.
we run out of material.
So I agree with Craig. I will add one more because they released ESPN this morning, since Craig sent these questions, added the 26 to 50 folks. So they just haven't done the top 25 yet. But so the left-handed pitchers on this list, they have Sandy Koufax at 32, Clayton Kershaw at 52, Lefty Grove 54, Carlton 58, Whitey Ford at 60. So I agree with Craig that Kershaw could be ahead of Verlander and Scherzer. You can make a case for Scherzer, like, still very strong as he's older, you know. But I'm okay with that for Kershaw. That said, I've written this before. I think Kershaw is better than Koufax. So I would rate him higher. He's been better longer. That's sort of the argument. Obviously, you know, postseason, if you want to talk about that, Koufax is better, but I just think Kershaw has a better body of work. That said, I think Lefty Grove is the best left-handed pitcher of all time. I think Grove should be in the 32 spot if we're sort of maneuvering these around. And I'm okay. I get why Kershaw would be ahead of Carlton, but yeah, Carlton, like, he did the whole thing, right? Like, his career is done. He has a long career. He won four Cy Youngs. He was really good. I'd be okay if Carlton was ahead of Kershaw, at least for now. But yeah, I think Grove should be the number one here in terms of just the left-handers. Just as an aside, I was looking this up. So Lefty Grove, he won 9 ERA titles. He led the league in strikeouts his first 7 years in the majors. He ended up winning 300 games. What was this? So his career ERA plus is 148, which is over 17 years. So Kershaw's at 155. He is through 14 years. Now, I was looking at Lefty Grove, like, let's just take his first 14 years, and it's so like where Kershaw's at now, and he's at 151. So they're kind of the same, but I think Lefty Grove did it for 3 more years. So I would say Grove is number one, but Kershaw has a chance to pass him eventually. But like, that's sort of where I'm at on this list right now.
Yeah, no, and you know, we know me. I know a little bit about the history of baseball, but nowhere near enough to really weigh on this heavily. Yeah. But your logic sounds sound to me.
Oh, also, I'm assuming, I guess Randy Johnson. I didn't see where he's. I'm assuming so. He might be in the top 25. You can make an argument for him as well. Like,
mm-hmm.
But like, it's a quibbling. I'm just talking about like of these guys. Like, I think I would still say Grove number one, but like, you know. It's splitting hairs at that point.
Right. You're in the all-time circle.
Right. Going yeah, on you, there. You wouldn't kick them out of the bed for eating crackers or whatever that old statement is.
Just kind of an aside on this. We're at the point where, like, who do you think is number one when this list comes out? Not who do you think is number one. Who do you think ESPN puts?
Willie Mays.
Yeah, that's my guess. And I think, you know, this is a thing that I would love to. This came up when we talked about Hank Aaron after he passed away, Henry Aaron after he passed away. Just where he fits in that list, because it feels like the top three is usually in some order Mays, Roof, and then Aaron. I think Ted Williams gets put in there as well. And I'm curious to see what do you think? Do you think that's the four? Am I missing someone that we should be talking about?
Bonds, but obviously yeah, and that's... with all the caveats, right? Like it's one of those where like Aaron is certainly great. Like Stan Musial is also like that. You look at his numbers and you're just like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
But then I always like look and he's not quite on that tier, but he's like just a notch below. But like Frank Robinson is like so good, but no one ever thinks of him as like a top five good, even though he might have been.
Yeah,
like he was like that. So yeah, it's crazy. Like, but yeah, it's probably. Or wait, you said Wait, did you say Ted Williams too?
I said Ted. It's frequently like it feels like Williams Bond's views are usually like after that three.
Yes.
Or for one reason or another.
And I think too, like Williams and Bonds are. I know Bonds won a bunch of Gold Gloves and left, and like he was actually really good defensively for a long time. Like Williams wasn't, but in terms of like they're more the like the pure hitting, heavy, like especially. But yeah, like it is interesting. Like, but that's a very solid group, and then it's just a matter of like where I'm interested to see. Like, they have a companion piece. I didn't read it. I just saw a headline. Also, where do you fit in, like, Oscar Charleston and maybe, I guess, Josh Gibson?
Is on this list. I just looked. Sorry.
Oh, he is. Okay.
He's number 35. So they might have
Oscar Charleston, like, in that, maybe, like, in the three spot or something like that. It's just, you know, I don't know, but, like, that it's probably right, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, it'll be interesting. I didn't put much thought into this list till Craig sent it, and I was like, okay, all right, it's we'll see how it goes. So clearly, Mookie should be number one.
One last quick aside on that is it's interesting to me that, like, you know, it sort of makes sense given where MVPs are, but that pitchers are never like how high can you put a pitcher basically? On a list like this, and that'll be interesting.
And I was wondering too, like, who do they put number one?
You mean
probably Walter Johnson, like in terms of pitchers, like,
right? I mean, you run into the Bonds thing with Clemens as the other,
Seaver, like it's all, and then I guess Randy Johnson is going to be in that top 25. I would imagine unless I missed him in the list, but yeah. Pedro, oh God!
Pedro is I was double checking that he hadn't been listed already, but I was about to say I hope he's in the top 25. So
right,
cool. That was a fun discussion. It'll be interesting to see. And if no news has come out, we might be discussing heavily because we ain't got nothing else. Whenever the 2022 season begins, that's a lot of twos. One thing we don't see, one thing we won't see, is Buster Posey behind the plate for the Giants. How big an impact do you think that will have for the Giants, and which team's offense will be affected more, Giants without Posey or the Dodgers without Seager?
Well, the big impact is that the Giants are clearly done. They're going to have a losing record. No. That was huge. I mean, he's like middle of the order guy. Very good. Obviously, they were using him judiciously. Like, they gave him regular rest. Like, they very rarely started him 3 days in a row. But he was awesome. Like, he's always been really, really good. So just missing that presence in the middle of the order is going to hurt. So I do think Seager, I mean, I know he was hurt for a lot of the year, but the last 2 years, he was on a different level in terms of hitting. I think sort of a new level for him, and the Dodgers are going to miss that greatly. So again, it was sort of talking about, like, obviously still in the lockout. One of the things once they restart again is teams have to build their rosters. And like you mentioned, Dodgers might need a few players like still. So
yeah, that's kind of what you and I are thinking, especially if there's still no news when we record next, we might make the best team we can given the 40 man only, it's like, wow, this is a really good team until you get to like the bench and the fourth starter or whatever.
I would say, and so just as a, just to give you an idea of that. So Dan Zimborski at Fangraphs this week, put out, Zips projections for like teams as they're constructed right now.
Uh-huh.
And the Dodgers are, their Zips record was like 94-68, which was the best in the National League. But again, with all the caveats of like razor thin, like starting depth and all that kind of stuff, but they're still really good. Just like it probably stand to be, as we saw in the playoffs, some of the people getting playing time, like,
well, they started the offseason last year with like arguably 9 starting pitchers, whatever. So they clearly need 15 now.
Exactly.
Just go out and get all of them.
Exactly right.
But please, Clayton Kershaw. With the Lunar New Year beginning for the Year of the Tiger, I am... Oh, sorry, I skipped one. I'm so hungry, I wanted to go to the food question. For the contest, and let's do this through the 2022 World Series, closest, no matter if you go higher, name the total amount of years for a franchise between winning the respective championship in the NFL, NHL, NBA, and Major League Baseball in 2022. For example, in 2021, the Buccaneers went 18 years between Super Bowl titles. The Lightning went 1 year. The Milwaukee Bucks went 50 years, and the Braves had a 26-year gap. That is a total of 95 years.
Yeah, I was looking at this, so, and I was trying to figure out how to account for, so like if the Bengals win,
yep,
they've never won a championship.
So it's when was their first year, right?
Now, is it first year or is it Super Bowl like era? So like, would it be 56 be the number for them, or?
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The first Super Bowl they did.
That's where my head was sort of at. Like, so my number here is 79. And my logic is I actually think the Rams will win, although it would not surprise me if the Bengals won. But I'm basically thinking that one of the Bengals or the Suns will win a championship because the Suns are at 50, this is their 54th season and they've never won. So I'm going to get the large number in there. And then
to keep this bet clean, you said 79?
Yeah.
78.
Okay.
We'll make this a nice over under.
I just sort of cheated. So my just back of the math, I think this works out. Rams 22 years. Lightning would be 3 in a row. I just went with that. Dodgers would be 2 years, and then Suns would be 54. So that's sure. How I came up with 79. And I didn't put any more time
You made this really easy because I did not think I didn't read this question ahead of time, so I was going to have to really scramble.
Yeah, I was like looking at it I stared at it for a second. I was like, I don't know what he's talking about. but what are we guessing? Do we guess the?
But the fact that you picked a team like one of either the Bengals or the Suns means I'll just say, no, it'll be four more recent-ish teams.
Exactly. We're gonna get Rams are 22. And you're it's basically, although it'd be funny if I win with all 22.
25, yeah. All right. With the this sounds familiar. With the Lunar New Year beginning for the Year of the Tiger, I am reminded of the mall food court with the ever-present Panda Express among your choices.
Obviously.
Jacob might recall the West Side Pavilion, which is no more. All of these mall names just conflate with me, so I had to remember which one this was. And this is the one near Westwood, across the street from Apple Pan. And I had no idea it had closed, and it's like Google offices now or something. Strange. Anyways, that might have been the last one I stopped by many years ago. Here's this week's question. Was going to a mall food court part of your routine if you were there to see a movie, hanging out at the arcade or shop? If so, name some of your favorite places if you recall. And for Jacob, when that day comes, is there some shopping mall close to you where you can take the stroller out, perhaps stop by a store for some treats to share with your family? I'll start in reverse. There is Oak Park Mall is in Kansas City, which isn't that far away. But these I worked in a mall twice, actually, the same mall in Santa Clarita. I hate malls, man. I've always, even when they were super popular, and now you have this kind of situation where the outdoor malls have really taken over as the popular choices. But there still seem to be like an indoor mall or like now and then that's really popular. But a lot of these, especially out here in the Midwest, are just really depressing, just empty.
Yeah, they're all dead now. It seems like. I grew up spending a lot of time in the shopping mall because my mom was a hairstylist, and the shop she worked at was in the Palm Springs Mall. So like either some scenarios where a lot of times I'd be at my grandma's house when my mom was at work or something. But sometimes like there would be literal days I had to be like old enough. So and like old enough being like 10 or 11, I think, where sometimes my mom would just take me to work and then I would hang out at the mall all day. And that is kind of boring, but like also
I mean, there was, you know, that era, I think, in the 80s and 90s, especially in Southern California, I think, where, like, there was sort of a magic. You know, eventually I did grow to just hate just how crowded they were and how claustrophobic I felt. But when they're, like, was reliably an arcade in a movie theater, and we'll get to the food part, a food court, it was kind of, especially for when you were of the age where you couldn't drive, it was kind of a nice place to be.
So not, it was in the same parking lot as the mall. There was, there was a movie theater, the Camelot movie theater, it wasn't attached to the mall, but it was like on the other end of the parking lot, which is also across the street from my high school. So I did, there were times where, and this was, I think, where I got this multiple movies in one sitting thing, where to kill time, I would just be at Camelot watching like three movies. And then,
did you buy three tickets?
Yes, because I was scared.
Yeah, no.
I
had friends that always wanted to do that.
My mom finding out I was getting.
Yeah, caught. I always bought my own ticket. Goody two shoes.
Now, but then I ended up having at a different movie theater. I had a bunch of friends work at that movie theater, so I got a lot of free movies on the back end. So no. But another thing before I get into the food too is so the Palm Springs Mall, it was also attached to like there was a Thrifty's, which had the greatest ice cream scoop ever, and then also there was a grocery store. But so this was a time in the 80s where I, as a child, and I don't know how they allowed this, but my mom like gave me a note, so it had to be before 1985. So I'm like, I'm nine at most in this. I go over to Thrifty's and I bought cigarettes for my mom. And because it's like, you know, it's not a small town, but it kind of people know. It's like, yeah, she works over here. They know who she is. So, and I had the money and I bought my mom cigarettes at like eight or nine and then brought them back to her. And they're like, yes, that's a thing that should be allowed. And so, yeah, what a time. What a time to be alive.
What was your favorite food place? We gotta get hungry.
So my favorite food place by far in the Palm Springs Mall was the Orange Bowl, and it was just a sort of standard catch-all, standard fare fast food mall diner-y type thing. They had a grill top. They had a bunch of fryers. The fries were really good. I would put them on the level of like bowling alley fries, and like I mean that in the most complimentary way possible. whether they also had like the standard like nacho dispenser that everyone had, nacho cheese dispenser. So like they had that. They had orange bang on machine there, which was wonderful. So like I had everything on that menu 17 times, I'm pretty sure, over the years. There were other places in the food court that like came and went, but it was Orange Bowl for me was like by far the tops. It was great.
I think because the Valencia Mall that I grew up around had dozen and a half food places in the food court, and I can't remember more than like three because so many of them were just not great. But the one that always stands out is the ubiquitous hot dog on a stick, which I loved.
Hot dog on a stick. So they did not have it at the Palm Springs Mall, but they did have a hot dog on a stick at the Palm Desert Town Center, which is where I don't know why. Like this was later when we could actually drive places, but that was a great. That had the awesome movie theater. But yeah, hot dog and a stick, wonderful. Just perfect.
Perfect.
Mall food. I would say the other thing I sort of associate with malls, and I think it was more later than growing up, but Sbarro is in like...
And you know what? I feel like as someone who loves pizza, Sbarro has always been disappointed. I think I remember even as a kid, like, it's pizza, so it's good. But man, pizza should be better.
I think I sort of liked it in the guise of, hey, that's pizza, and pizza's good.
I still ate, especially when I was at UCLA Swirl, a lot, because it's still pizza. But
I'm not sure if I've ever technically had food poisoning, but I think the one time I probably did was after a Sbarro.
Yeah.
And I still went back like 2 weeks later to the same Sbarro because it's pizza and it was cheap. So yeah, that tells you all you need to know. I think we should go have mall food. What about you?
Corn dog sounds great.
You know what? You know what? There's actually a hot dog on a stick not too far from me, and now I want to go drive there. So, all right, let's end this. Everyone go eat a corn dog, eat a Sbarro.
Cheese on a stick, hot dog on a stick.
Exactly. Go to your nearest mall, go to your favorite food court spot, and just go to town and do that while you're listening to this podcast, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening.
Bye.